The Bible and Human Freedom, Responsibility, and Moral Maturity was presented by Ron Julian at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We have a lot of passages that we looked at today. And as I was thinking about this, there is a danger in the little scattershot passages that we're looking at. And you probably know what that danger is. It's the dreaded proof texting. The idea that I want to prove a point, so I go pull a verse out of context and throw it at somebody. The problem with proof texting, of course, is not that I would refer to a verse to make a point, because everybody does that. Jesus did that. Jesus quoted the scriptures and made points from them. All the apostles did that. It's not that there's anything wrong with that. But the problem is the tendency, once that I pull it out of its context, is to forget what it is that the person who wrote it was actually trying to say, and thus what the implications of that really ought to be. Many of you know that the founding principles of Gutenberg College, at least one of the founding principles of Gutenberg College, is the dedication to fostering the skill of reading the Bible. I mean, that's where a lot of us around here started, is we, through one road or another, became dedicated to trying to be more careful readers of the Bible in the sense of trying to pay attention to, when Paul was writing to the Galatians, what can we figure out about what was the problem that he was speaking to? And in this context, when he says some provocative thing, what specifically is he getting at, and can I apply that more generally, and so on. That's been a very, very deep concern around here for a long time. So we would be really disappointed if we ended up fostering in you the impression that all we need to do is just throw some verses at you and quote them, and then we've made our point. So what I want to kind of focus on today is I'm going to select some of the passages that we looked at and leave it to you to ask questions about if you have interests from your discussions and some of the other ones. But I'd like to look at these passages and think about how do I move from what Jesus said or what Paul said in these passages to actually thinking about how I might think that a government should run, or what I might think about democracy, because it's not so easy necessarily to do. Let me describe. This isn't the place for a lecture on exegesis, but let me just describe real briefly how I think this process needs to work. First, we seek to understand what the author is saying to his original readers in their original situation. What's the issue? What is on the author's mind? And it's one of this very important thing. One of the first things you really have to learn to be a good reader of the Bible is to not go barging into a text with your questions, but to kind of try to put them aside and figure out what were the questions that were on the table for the author and his readers here. That's, you're not really going to get anywhere with it unless you do that. So we believe in that very much. After I've understood what it is the author is saying in this situation, then I want to try to understand the underlying principles that informed what the author said. Why did he say this? Did he say that the Corinthians should do X because X is a universal moral good that every person ought to do at all times? Or did he say that the Corinthians ought to do X because in their particular cultural situation it made sense to do X, and it was because of an underlying moral principle that he was applying in a particular situation? That makes a great deal of difference to us. So I'm looking for why did the author say what he said? And then I want to try in my life to take the things that I'm learning about what Jesus understood God to be about, what Jesus understood human life to be about, what Paul understood about those things, about who God is or human nature or what God has promised or all those sorts of things. What I want to try to build up a picture of, how does God look at the world? As he has revealed himself in the scriptures, how does he look at this world that I live in? How does he look at me? How does he look at life? And I'm trying to develop a worldview that is informed by these, the understanding of the prophets and Jesus and the apostles. And then, when it comes to deciding how to live, I'm going to apply that worldview. I always very much liked David's saying, when David used to teach on this process of application and that sort of thing, is you don't apply a verse, you apply a worldview. And I think that's exactly right, is that you understand from the verses of the Bible how the biblical authors looked at the world, how God taught them to look at the world, and then we try to look at the world the same way. And when I have the right view of the world, then I will understand better how I ought to live in it. So that's the process that we're trying to deal with. So in the passages that we're looking at today, I think it's appropriate for us to try to first sort out, okay, what was the situation? What was it that Paul or Jesus was saying? And then trying to understand what implications that might have in another situation. And what we're trying to think about is government, about democracy and that sort of thing. I just want to be very clear right up front. There is a kind of a talk that somebody could give, which would be, here is my synthesis of the biblical view of the issue of freedom and human responsibility as it applies to government forms, the master, the big picture, you know, with hundreds of verses brought in and all that kind of stuff. That's not even close to what I'm doing today. What I'm doing, and I think you've started to see that in this forum, in the Summer Institute, we're not setting out to write a book on some topic and then come lecture it at you. This is kind of a sampler. You know, let's look a little bit at an author over here and let's look at some biblical passages over here to get a feel for what some of the issues are and how one might approach them. But this is just kind of a beginning to the process. So what I want to do today is just pick a couple of these passages that we were looking at and talking about and think about what is it that's going on in them and what has led to what's being said there, and does it have implications for the way we think about government stuff. Understanding who you're dealing with here, I've spent a lot of time in my life studying the Bible and teaching it, so it's not that I'm an expert, but if I have anything to say, it's probably something about that. I am not a political theorist. I'm saying, like any of you, as I sit and look at these passages, what would I do? Where would they take me in this quest to try to understand this? And that's really my only goal today, to give myself as a very humble little model of how I think you might go about doing this. And then let's make sure and have your questions about not only what I say, but the passages that I'm not going to talk about and whatever. So I thought I'd start with Paul's instructions that we see in Thessalonians and Timothy about the practice of charity in the church. In 1 Timothy 5, Paul speaks about the support of widows in the church. Honor widows who are widows indeed. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. Now she who is a widow indeed and who has been left alone has fixed her hope on God and continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. But she who gives herself to wanton pleasure is dead even while she lives. Prescribe these things as well, so that they may be above reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. well, I'm not going to go into all of the things involved there. We don't know precisely what this practice was. There may be someone who thinks they know precisely what this practice was. I'm not one of them. We do know that women in this society depended on the status and protection of their husbands. A woman without a husband or children to look out for her could be in a very vulnerable situation. As we were talking about in our group, there's a great difference in this cultural situation between, you have these two couples. In this couple, the woman dies, and in this couple, the man dies. The situation of the surviving spouse is very different in the case of the man and the woman. That she could very easily, in that cultural situation, have a very difficult time taking care of herself. So this passage is clearly dealing with how the church might financially support widows in this situation, although there seems to be something specific going on here that's a little difficult to sort out. But there seems to be this practice that a widow could make a special pledge to dedicate herself to staying unmarried, helping the church, pursuing the faith, and in turn she would be financially supported by the church. So the reason we say that is there's that strange thing that Paul says in there that you don't want to put a widow who's too young on there because she might get married again. Well, what's the problem with a widow getting married? He seems to imply that there has been a pledge that has been made that she is going to dedicate herself to the things of the faith and not get married again or something. Some kind of a dedicated religious life or something. It's hard to know exactly what that looks like, but there seems to be something like that going on. The part that's of interest to me here, and I think is of interest to us as we're thinking about this stuff, is Paul's instruction that she must truly be without anyone to help her before she is enrolled on the list for this support from the church. If she has children or grandchildren, then they are the ones who should be taking care of her. He uses this very strong language, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So there, he sees this as a very serious situation, that a family, children, would not be taking care of their widowed mother. Now, here's where I think we need to be clear as we set out to see the implications of this. Paul is talking about the behavior of believers in a congregation of believers. I think it's fair to say that he is concerned about the Christian discipleship of the people that he's talking to. He's not just concerned with practical issues, whether the widows are going to get fed or not. He's concerned with how are Christian people conducting themselves. Are they taking on responsibilities that God would see as theirs? Are they rebelling against God in the way that they're living their lives, and so on? So I'd say almost more than a practical, let's get this widow charity thing sorted out, is Paul's concern about the spiritual health of the people who are practicing this stuff. But there are some aspects of what Paul says that we can think about in terms of where do these ideas come from? What is it that he values, and why might that be the case? We can see that there is something dishonorable about not taking care of your own family. We can imagine the situation. The widow's children say, "Hey, Mom, you're a widow. You should get in on that money that they're giving out at the church." And there's something nice about that, because if you get in on that money, then I don't have to give you any of my money. Paul sees that as being so ungodly that he describes those children as being worse than unbelievers. Why would he say that? He doesn't spell out what the moral principle is or what would lead him to condemn this in such strong language. we could think of it in terms of there are some things that I am obligated to do because I have been commanded to do so as some sort of religious obligation. If we were to look back and say, well, Jesus gave a commandment that you're supposed to take care of your mother or something like that, and it's a unique commandment to Christians somehow, that then, okay, so if you're a follower of Christ, you obey this somewhat, you know, strange and arbitrary little command, but otherwise you wouldn't have any reason to do something like that. Well, that's probably not the case here. As we think about it, it's probably not the case that this is some strange, esoteric Christian command that Paul's saying you're violating. It seems to be more fundamental than that, that there's something rooted in what human relationships are supposed to be about, in essential morality as God has made us to live. So a couple of things come to mind that he may be thinking here that seem likely to me. First of all, they're abusing the generosity of the church. That money is meant for widows who are widows indeed, that is, those who are without support. For a family that can afford to take care of their mother, to take money meant for those without means is harmful to those people in the church. So it's a violation of the law of love, basically. Would I want to be treated that way? I know somebody who is quite capable of taking care of themselves, and yet they're relying on me to take care of them instead. That doesn't seem right. I wouldn't want to be treated that way. I shouldn't treat other people that way. But I think there is something more to it than that, because I think Paul is sort of warning against not just the practical outcome that, hey, those people are getting ripped off. They don't have as much money because you didn't take care of your mom. But there is something essentially destructive to the soul of someone who would do something like this, to choose to basically kind of in a way defraud the believers in your midst just so you don't have to pay money to your mother. There's something wrong with that. That's a choice that comes from a hard and unbelieving heart. And so to reinforce someone in that kind of behavior is not to be helpful to them at all. They're essentially abandoning a burden that is theirs by right. There is a dignity and honor to taking on one's responsibilities, and our parents are part of our responsibilities. To make the church do what they should do is greedy and ultimately unbelieving. Instead of trusting God to take care of them as they accept the responsibilities he has given, they're copping out and greedily saving their own money while others pick up the slack. So there's something, I think, it seems to me, Paul doesn't say it, so you could argue I'm reading too much into it, but I think when we put the whole biblical picture together, that Paul would say that situation is not good for the church. It is a violation against the church and is harmful to them in some ways, but even more so, it is a detriment to the soul of the person who's doing it. You don't want to reinforce that kind of behavior. Okay, so another principle that we can see in this passage, it seems to me, which is quite striking and something to definitely think about, Paul is not afraid to say, just because there is a material need, the church should not necessarily meet it. Okay, so I got myself tangled up in knots in there. What the idea here, right, is that Paul is saying, no, don't put widows on the list who have a family that can take care of them. He's not saying the essential thing is that you take care of everybody who has a need. In this case, and materially take care of anyone who has a need. In this case, you're supposed to be thinking also about the impact of your decision to provide financial support on the person that you're supporting and the people that should be supporting them and all of that sort of thing. So it's not good for widows and their children to be given financial support when they are capable of taking care of themselves. Love does not always translate into meeting people's material needs. Sometimes what they need more is to face into their own responsibilities. So I think that it's fair to say in this passage that this is the kind of thing that we see motivating Paul to be so critical of this behavior. It is unloving toward the church. It is an unbelieving and hard-hearted stance to take, which is destructive to the person who takes that stance. And thus, we can see that in some situations it is appropriate to give material support, and in other situations it is not appropriate to give it. Okay, so and then we can see the same sort of thinking in the Second Thessalonians passage. Now we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you keep aloof from every brother who leads an unruly life, and not according to the tradition which you received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example, because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with labor and hardship we kept working night and day, so that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have the right to do this, but in order to offer ourselves as a model for you, that you might follow our example. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order: if anyone will not work, neither let him eat. For we hear that some among you are leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. Now such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and eat their own bread. But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary of doing good. Okay, so a lot we could talk about in that passage, but let me just highlight the things that are similar to the other passage. Paul himself chose not to be financially supported by them, but he worked to support himself. And he says he did this to model the importance of not living an irresponsible, undisciplined life. He didn't want to model for them, here's someone who comes in and expects you to take care of him. Even though he's saying, I could have done that, there's nothing wrong with it. In principle, there is nothing wrong with me accepting financial support from you for the work of teaching the gospel that I'm doing. I could have done that. It would have been okay. But I chose not to because I thought it would be helpful to you to see a model of someone being concerned for his own welfare, which is appropriate. And he specifically instructed them not to give food or financial support to someone who could work but would not. Their irresponsibility, the irresponsibility of that person, was reflected by the fact that they were not working and they wasted their time instead being busybodies. I mean, it kind of multiplied. Not only did they not do the work that they ought to do to take care of themselves, but then they had all this free time and they went around causing trouble. And like I mentioned in our group, in reading that part, when I read that part, I can't help thinking that Paul must have particular people in mind in Thessalonians. That it is not just he's reflecting, gee, I bet that it could happen that if somebody wasn't working that they could end up being a busybody. I'll bet that he knows exactly who he's talking about in this situation. So I think we see some of the same kinds of principles here. There is something wrong with not meeting your responsibilities, in this case, your responsibility to take care of yourself. And I would suspect that the sorts of things we would point to, the similar kinds of things. It is unloving to others to put the burden on them that you will not take on yourself. There is something just unfaithful and unbelieving about living in that way that is not a good place to live. And again, you as the church do not want to reinforce the thinking of someone who's in that spot. You want to call them to confront the fact that they have an obligation to take care of themselves. And again, it can be loving for a church to say no when someone wants financial support. If we looked at the larger biblical picture, I think it's clear that Paul would say that the goal in saying no is not vindictive, but redemptive. The reason that he's saying no is it's not that sort of, oh, don't let that creep have any money, he's not working. I mean, it's more that the idea that we don't want to be enablers of other people's irresponsibility because there's something bad about that irresponsibility. It's not good for the people around them, and it's not good for them either. They are they are losing. If we encourage them to stay in that spot, they are losing something very important. All right. So now we get to the tricky part. If when we look at those passages, what does this say about how we think about governmental institutions and democracy and all of that stuff? Because Paul's main concern, like I said, is with the authenticity of one's Christian discipleship. To refuse to trust God and take on my God-given responsibilities is faithless and may actually signal that I am not really a believer at all. I mean, that's how seriously he takes this. And so on those grounds, I certainly don't believe that it is the role of government to test the validity of my Christian discipleship. I don't think that we as Christians want to have government implement laws that make it so there can't be any phony Christians. You have to be tested in your devotion to the faith. I don't want the government administering that test, frankly, because I'm not sure they're competent to do so. No, let me say a different way. I am sure they are not competent to do so. Okay, so, but it seems to me that when we think about the kinds of things that Paul is appealing to there, that they are rooted in fundamental truths about human nature. I would argue that government, as well as the church, has to sort out what it truly means to help people. And it is not helpful for anyone, government or not, to free me from my responsibilities for myself. Nor is it helpful to free me from my responsibilities to help my family and others under my influence. And this is a debate that has been happening in the political life of our country. But forgive me if I'm ignorant about this. This is an example that came to my mind, and maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But I'm thinking back to the set of welfare reforms that were implemented under the Clinton administration. Those reforms, as I understand it, moved in the direction of encouraging people who could work to get work. The goal was not to withhold welfare from people who needed it, but to reform the system such that it was not becoming an incentive not to work. So there were things added to it to move people through the system toward having productive work. And my understanding is that studies have shown that those reforms had a good result, that they were effective and they turned out to be a good idea. Well, that seems to be, to me, to be in keeping with the principles that I think we see in this passage, that it is not healthy for a human being to shirk his or her responsibility for himself or for family. And that's something that human societies have recognized by and large. I mean, we all sort of recognize that there's something wrong with someone whose family is hurting and they could be helped, but that person won't take on the responsibility to do it. Or someone who is constantly taking advantage of others to support themselves in a way when they're quite capable of doing it themselves. You don't have to be a believer to recognize that there seems to be something anti-human about that. That's not the way we ought to live. Now, we were talking in our group, and I maybe it would be good to bring this up. Chris raised the question about, so on what basis, you know, in the larger society, as I'm entering into political discussion and I'm talking to unbelievers and we're talking about these principles, how am I going to convince them that this is in fact, you know, what I ought to do? That's not really the issue that I'm setting out to talk about here in this case. It's possible that we wouldn't be able to win that argument. I think it's a complex combination of, well, I'm talking off the top of my head here a little bit, but it seems to me that obedience to God's commands for human life is a multifaceted thing. Part of it has to do with my willingness to bow to the will of God, and that could be true if he were to just say to me, there's no particular moral imperative that you don't wear, mix the fabrics on your clothes together when you get dressed, but nonetheless I have commanded you to do it. It would be appropriate for me to keep that command as a command of God. But a lot of the stuff that God has given us, the moral principles that he has given us, they are in keeping with the world that he has made. So I'm not afraid of saying that obedience both has that individual me relating to God aspect, but it also has the aspect that I am either living in sync with the world that God has created or not. So in a sense, all human beings, in having the moral sense that has been given to them by God, being made in the image of God, I think all human beings, we don't ultimately need to defend the idea of fundamental moral truths. It's not our obligation to come along and say, see, I can prove that you shouldn't murder someone. I mean, in that sense, it's kind of more like what we were talking about today, the classical liberalism versus the modern liberalism, or the English individualism versus the continental. That idea that there are things that we have learned in human experience that we're not smart enough to come along and say, well, maybe it's not true. Maybe it's okay to murder people or something. I mean, that we have a personal experience, a collective experience as human beings, and a moral sense, I think, that has been given to us by God, all that would kind of move in those directions. What I'm interested here in is, when I as a believer look at this passage, do I see a principle that I think has a wider application than just to the church? And it seems to me that the principles that we were talking about there do have a wider application, that it is, whether a believer or unbeliever, it is unjust to put the burden of my support on other people when I can take it myself. It is unhealthy for me to live in that way, and I shouldn't be reinforced in that kind of thinking. And so it is appropriate at times to think about more than just giving something, but it's actually appropriate to ask the question, is it wise or not in this situation to step in and meet that need? And like I say, I would see the example of that welfare reform as being a place where our political institutions considered that issue and actually were thinking about the question, are we actually helping people if we don't consider the impact of this on their character in the sense of what we're reinforcing in their thinking. So we can talk about this. I'm perfectly prepared to hear the argument that I have stepped too far, that this is not legitimate to move from this passage about the church to the way the government works. But I hope I've been clear as to why I think it's legitimate to make that step. And I would do that. I mean, it informs my thinking as I think about this stuff. So if I'm wrong in doing that, you should tell me why, because that would be helpful. And then I can argue with you and convince you that you're wrong. So next, let's look at the Luke 22 passage. And there arose also a dispute among them as to which one of them was regarded to be greatest. This is the disciples of Jesus. This is on the night of his arrest. This is the upper room. It depends on what picture you have of the Last Supper. But usually, you know, you kind of have this picture of this very solemn occasion, and Jesus is at the head, and they're all looking at him sort of sorrowfully, like, oh, this is such a somber night. You don't really think of them sitting around arguing, no, you know, I'm a lot more important in this deal than you are. But that seems to be what was happening. So Jesus says to them, let me back up here. Let's try to sort out what's happening. They're arguing about who's the greatest. I think It's likely that they have this expectation that things are about to wrap up. This last week in Jesus' life, going into Jerusalem, the triumphal entry and all of this, it sure looks like Jesus has finally sort of taken on the mantle and he's ready to do something. So I think they're thinking, wow, we're about to get into high gear here in this kingdom of God stuff, and you know who we are? We're the right-hand men of the Messiah. That's who we are. So when this all gets going, which one of us is like, you know, his really right-hand man is the issue. And I think that's the kind of thing that has led to this. And why do we have conversations like that, or why do we have desires like that? What's motivating them? Well, there's something personally gratifying about being an important person, about being a person with power and authority. You go wander. You picture yourself wandering around the kingdom of God. Here's the king on his throne over here, and people want to see the king. They come to you. So we really like to talk to the king about stuff. I said, well, let me check his schedule. You know, and you know, I mean, there's something about that that's very personally gratifying. I mean, I want to be a person who has an important role like that. And this is the most important person in the universe, and I'm like right next door. I mean, I'm just right one level below the most important person in the universe. That's got to be cool, right? I mean, I'd love that. So I think what Jesus is speaking to here is that desire for that gratification of power. So Jesus asked them to kind of contrast the way the kings of the nations of the earth think about and use power. First, he says, they lord it over the nations, lord it over the Gentiles. So I think what he's getting at is they delight in the fact that they're the boss, and they definitely exercise their option to be the boss because there's something really satisfying about being the boss. But then secondly, he says, they are called benefactors. This is in fact a title that many rulers of the time adopted, or people would refer to their rulers in this way. And it has to do with, as I understand it, with a very simple thing. I mean, we've got a ruler. Hey, he put in a public water system and he built a Colosseum so we could go watch games. And, you know, we're talking bread and circuses and all of that kind of stuff. The people who do that, their people say, wow, he is a benefactor. He really has been nice to us. He's given us what we're looking for. So there is this situation. So the kings of the Gentiles, they do these two things. They delight in the exercise of their power of being the boss. That's satisfying. And they delight in keeping their power and achieving a certain amount of glory by being the benefactor of the people. There's something nice about everybody looking at you going, wow, we're so happy that you're king because you give us what we want. So I think that's the kind of thing that Jesus is referring to. This is the sort of gratification that they're looking for from being in power. Jesus is urging the disciples to think of authority in the light of serving those that I have the authority over. He says, as my disciples, you should follow my lead. I am, in fact, the most important guy in the universe. And yet I have taken a stance of service, not personal power and gain. I mean, it's just undeniably true that Jesus lived a life that was given over to serving his people, calling his people together. He lived a very hard life. And that this very night, we know, as John tells, Jesus does the thing of washing the disciples' feet, which was the thing that a servant would do when you came into the house. Here he is, this is the night, you know, focused on what he is about to go through and the importance of his role and everything, and yet he takes this occasion to take the lowly role of the servant. Okay, so obviously Jesus' immediate concern is to foster in his people a heart of service. especially among those like the disciples who have a role involving some authority over others. But tangentially, and I think it is tangentially, Jesus' remarks are an interesting window into a feature of human behavior as it relates to government. There is an unhealthy kind of mutual codependency that can develop between citizens and rulers. People want to be taken care of, and rulers want the approval and power that comes from giving people what they want. So we can have this situation where those in power are seeking to keep that power and be personally gratified by being seen as benefactors. What they're looking for is the to bask in that role. He's urging his disciples to not be like that. Instead, they should seek to be true servants. And we can see in the context of the church where the disciples have a certain authority and there will be others who have authority. There will be elders and teachers and so on who are in a position of having a certain responsibility for other people. And Jesus is warning against this, you know, don't get into this mindset of lording it over people and being called benefactor so that you can gain this gratification from the role. The point is to serve the people that you have authority over. So Jesus is pointing to this, I think, as ultimately a spiritual problem. That is, for his disciples, for people who are going to be in positions of authority in the church, there's something ungodly about taking the role on for the way that it can gratify my desire for power and glory instead of being in the role in order to actually serve other people. That's what he's concerned about. He's concerned about the spiritual health of his disciples who are sitting there arguing over who's more important. I mean, so he said, wait a minute. There's something really wrong with this picture. But, like I say, as this little side window in what he's saying, he gives this perspective that he has on what happens out there in the world of governments and people being governed. And I think he's right to look at that and say, oh yeah, Jesus needed my approval. I think he's got that one right. I think what I meant to say is, I hope that I'm right in understanding him to be saying that if we look around, governments can preserve their own power and privileges by playing the role of benefactor, but ultimately it can be a self-serving, poor imitation of genuine service. And I think we've seen in the political life of our own country that there are those who enter into the political process, I would like to think, with some attitude of genuine service to their country. And it is also quite possible in the political arena to take on that thing that, look, here's my opportunity in our own United States Republic way to provide the bread and circuses and end up with power and approval by doing that. And the flip side of this is that citizens want such benefactors, that we can fall into the place of, instead of looking to those who lead with wisdom and are seeking to actually serve our best interests, that what we end up looking for is the guy that we can put the label benefactor on because I got what I was looking for out of it. That seems to me to be at least one of the things that we can see in the story about Israel wanting a king that we looked at. On the one hand, they're in a very different situation than we are. And it is very different, and we have to understand that it's very different. They are a true theocracy. That word gets kicked around. You know, if I should decide that I think it is immoral to abort children and that government should protect those children from being aborted, and if part of my reasoning is that I believe that God has given that life and that it is presumptuous of us to take that life for our own convenience, it has become the practice in our society to accuse me of wanting a theocracy. that because my Christian principles are informing what I think are how our government ought to act, oh, you Christians are trying to set up a theocracy. We just might point out that's nothing to do with what a theocracy is. Israel was a theocracy. This is rule by God. God was revealing himself to Israel. This is what I want you to do. He had people that actually talked to him so that he could talk to them. And so they were genuinely, when they made a choice to go in a certain direction, in this case, then they said, we want a king, this was in the situation where they already had a king, God. God was their king. Why did they do that? It doesn't spell it out a lot in the passage, and at this spot it would probably be better if David was giving this talk than me, because he's a lot more knowledgeable about what's going on in Samuel than I am, I think. But I think, as we look at it, what is it that they want? They're jealous of the other nations because the other nations have a king who has amassed power and he has an army. And that king, he's right there, tangible, and they can go to him and say, those guys want to beat up on us, you go beat up on them first. I mean, we want somebody to be right there to take care of us the way we want to be taken care of. Why do nations win wars? They have a big king to fight for them. Well, we want one of those as well. This is why God tells Samuel that they are rejecting God in asking for a king. You know, he kind of pats him on the back. You know, Samuel, I know. Now you see what it's like, huh? These people, you know, ever since I led them through the wilderness, this is what they do to me all the time. Is they keep saying, we don't want you, we want something else. We're starving out here in the wilderness. Forget God, let's kill Moses and go back to Israel. I mean, Egypt. So God's basically saying to Samuel, yeah, tell me about it. You know, this is the way they do it all the time. So this is, I know that they're not listening to you about this king issue, but the real issue is they're not listening to me. So we're going to give them that king. They don't want to be at the mercy of this invisible God who seems to keep his own counsel. I mean, the problem with trusting God in this world is that God keeps his own timetable and he consults his own interests when he decides whether he's going to make it known what he's doing and why he's doing it and all that kind of stuff. The thing is, you got a king, he's right there, you can storm the gates and go up and say, what the heck are you doing? And you'd better do it different or we're going to throw you out and get another king or something, you know. So I think in the story we see they have explicitly rejected the God who has revealed himself to them for the sake of more tangible benefits. Now, could we apply this? Could we say, so this passage tells us that it's wrong to have a king? If I was in Britain, I would have said, we shouldn't have a king. In the United States, should I say, we're wrong to have a president? Or should I say, it's good we have a president because he's not a king? Or, I mean, none of that, I think, is actually a good way to apply what's going on from these passages. Because, as I say, this is a very specific situation in the theocracy of Israel. God did not make the promises to America that he made to Israel. I just should probably say at this point that we in the church have had this habit of, what's that verse? If my people who are called by my name will pray and surrender and heal their land and all of that kind of stuff. I would argue that has to be understood in the context of the covenant that God made with Israel. That is not just a verse that you can pull out and apply to believers all over. But we tend to do that sort of thing. So what can I do with a passage like this? Well, what I think we can see, at least, is an illustration that the people of Israel there are very much like the people that Jesus is kind of hinting at when he talks about the rulers being called benefactors. You have this symbiotic relationship. You have a people who are looking for immediate benefit, and then you have the ones who are happy to give that benefit so they can have the power and glory that comes with that. And it's also striking for us to notice, it's very interesting, and you get into political discussions, especially if you have the sort of inclinations that I do in the political area, which are probably, well, let's just say I'm not setting myself up as a political thinker here. But you look at what Israel does, its willingness to give its freedom up for security. It's just very striking the way God tells Samuel to go tell him, You know, if you have a king, there's going to be a lot of blowback for you here that you're not going to like. All of a sudden, you got somebody telling you what to do that you didn't have before. Right now, you've got God telling you what to do, and you don't like that. Well, having a king telling you what to do is not going to necessarily be any better. I mean, you may find that to be worse, actually. You're going to lose freedom in this process. And that, I think, is interesting to us as we think about the potential problems in human government. So I think it's in keeping with the sort of thing that Jesus said. People want to be gratified through the promise of material security. Rulers want to be gratified through the power and glory that comes through giving people what they want. And that is still a problem in human interaction and government today. So that's all the passages I want to look at. I'll leave it to you to bring up other things that you might want to talk about. Let me just say these passages have their rightful focus on our attitude towards God. I mean, primarily the concern here is how is an individual responding to God? With trust and obedience, with repentance, or with a worldly disregard of what God wants. So we've seen it's faithless and unbelieving to refuse to take responsibility for yourself or your family. Paul's concerned with the eternal implications of such faithless living. He really is concerned with what does this say about the spiritual health of the people who are doing it. So he urges the church not to enable irresponsibility, and he urges individuals to take on their responsibilities. But the reasons why irresponsibility is a bad thing and destructive resonate, I think, in the human experience. It's true for everybody, whether you're a believer or not. No human being is helped by being encouraged to be irresponsible. And I think when we think about what has led Paul to say that, we would see that is a legitimate implication of what he says. Likewise, it is our relationship with God that's in view in the passages that deal with authority. As believing leaders, we should not pander to people's baser instincts so we can gain power, but we should truly serve. As believing members of a community, we should not, as Israel did, abandon following God to gain supposedly worldly benefits from those who are leading us. We should follow those who are leading us into godliness and wisdom. But I think it's fair to say that, once again, that these things that are bad for believers are bad for everyone. Leaders of government need to distinguish between pandering to and serving their people. And the one is destructive and the other is helpful. And citizens need to choose wisdom over the person who promises a chicken in every pot. So I think that ultimately the things that we see there, while they're not directly talking about the things that we see in government, do tell us things about how God has made the moral and relational life of human beings such that they do tell us something that's useful in, as we think about government. Now, these are not the only things that we have to think about, and let's end with that, is that we recognize that there are a lot of other things that the Bible has to say about things, but I just offer that as an example of how I would think about the relationship, how we might step outside the specific area of the church and faith in God to ask how it might influence the larger community.